Rabbi Rakefet.
Generally, I have to be honest, I don't speak to high school groups. I always worry, will they understand me? And people run after me to speak, so it's not that I lack speaking opportunities. But you have to understand that nothing is more important to the future of Torah than the Rebbe-Talmud relationship. We have an oral tradition. If you want to be a good Jew and say, I'm just going to study the Bible, the written word, you will not be a good Jew. You would be a good human being, and an ethical human being, and a moral human being. But to be a good Jew, it's more than just being a good human being. We have a lifestyle, a culture, a Shabbat, a kashrut, family purity, our values. At times we are totally different than the values around us. I need not go further than the United States of America and laws that have been passed here recently, examples set by the president, by members of Congress and Senate that we feel are alien to us. And that is part of the oral Torah, the relationship between the earlier generation and the new generation to be sure that there will be a generation tomorrow. And when Joanna, who was my student, very special, and Mark and their greater families, Joanna's uncle today is one of my prized students. So I couldn't say no, and I see you're a lovely group. And I'm going to share with you a little bit of some of what life means to me. Malka, my wife, and you know, without a wife, you get nowhere in life. Chazal already said, "Akol acharei ha'isha." Everything we achieve in life is the woman who's with us. So Malka was on a bus recently in Yerushalayim, and a bus in Jerusalem is very different than a bus here. You get on a bus here, you don't talk to anyone, you sit in your seat, you talk with your friend. When you get on a bus in Jerusalem, where we have the miracle of miracles that following the Holocaust, following 2,000 years of exile, that we are able to return and become a thriving country, and we take in so many different Jews from so many different cultures, so many different backgrounds. So here Malka's on the bus just a week ago, a week and a half ago, and this lady is sitting next to her, and the lady is writing in Arabic and reading Arabic. And Malka looks at her and she looks at Malka and they strike up a conversation. And the lady says, yes, I come from Iran and I owe my life to the Jewish agency. Malka looks at her, what do you mean you owe your life? And she started talking how the Secret Service of Israel, the Mossad, the equivalent of the CIA, set up an uncle, a so-called uncle, quote, end quote, in Turkey. And this uncle invited his relatives to visit him in Turkey. And Iran allowed this Jewish family to leave to visit the uncle. And the minute they came to Turkey, she kept on telling Malka, my wife, this tall, good-looking man with blonde hair. Evidently, in an Arab country, you don't see too many people with blonde hair. That happens to be a fact. They have darker features. This tall, good-looking man with blonde hair immediately showed us identity, took us to a beautiful hotel. 3 days later, they woke us up, and we're put on a plane that is going to Israel. And she said, I owe everything. And this woman was sitting next to my wife and praising how the state of Israel saved her family. I need not tell you, I was minding my own business. I taught Torah, it's my 56th year. I began on an elementary school level in 59. There were no kollelim then. I don't know if your rabbis remember that. If you wanted to get married, you had to make a living. Also, we were brighter kids, very simply. We didn't have the English translations that you have, Schottenstein, Art Scroll. I've been reading more Hebrew than English since the age of 12. I'm probably more at home in reading Hebrew than English. You know, to speak them, of course, I speak them interchangeably, but reading, I'm probably more at home in Hebrew. So we already knew how to learn. If you want to get married, got to teach, taught Talmud Torah. You don't know what that is. That was, kids went to public school. I would teach them in the afternoon. Then I taught high school kids. Then I came in Aliyah and I taught college kids. And then in 78 on, I began teaching postgraduate. And one day I'm minding my own business, May of 1980, and what I'm about to tell you in my seventh book, From Washington to Washington, From Washington Avenue to Washington Street, it's an OU publication, you can get all the details. But will you believe the book? I don't believe it. A little kid from the Bronx, that we did this? So you don't have to believe my book anymore. The Mossad came out with a book in Hebrew this very year, B'Nativ Hadmama, The Silent Path, and Malka and yours truly are the stars of the book. So you don't have to believe the Rebbe now. You can believe the Mossad. Does the Mossad lie on a Wednesday in North Miami Beach? I don't think so. I hope not. Joanna, May of 1980, I get a call. My father was very ill at the time, and he died shortly thereafter. And I jumped up. I thought for sure it's the hospital calling. And it was a call that you get once in a lifetime that changes your life. The call was in Hebrew. I'll say it in English. Rabbi Rakefet, can you accept the call without revealing contents of the call? B'li legalot et pratei hasicha. I said, I have to be honest with you girls. I've taught a lot of Torah and I've gotten calls from students anonymously, and I don't want to tell you why it was anonymous. They think I'm a father confessor. I tell them, you're in the wrong religion. When a person sins, they have to repent. I cannot help you. I can just tell you what you're doing is not proper. So I figured it's a call from a student who he or she doesn't want to identify himself. It was a call from a lady who I became very close with, a secretary to the boss. We never referred to the name of our operator, of our handler, the man in the Mossad who would later win the highest award in Israel for what he did for Russian Jewry. And he said to me, Rabbi Rakefet, we know that you know how to teach Gemara. Would you be willing to teach Gemara in Russia? And boy, that is quite a question. And I was either the fool or had the guts to say, why not? Who will you take with you? I say, my wife. What will you do with your children? He lists out all my children. I started to shake. I say, wow, this is serious. And they made an appointment with us, a very difficult address to find. I only realized later why they did it that way, because we had to find addresses in communist Russia where, believe me, until today, I don't know how I did it. Only the one above guided us. Communist Russia, you had maps that were not accurate, so you would get lost. This was on purpose. The KGB was a communist state. You have no idea what a communist state is. You know a little bit about Cuba, but you just think what Russia was before the Iron Curtain fell. And we were briefed. We had already, unknown to us, gone through a security check that cleared us for the mission. You have to get a security clearance. I had to get the As I got more involved, I had to get the greater security clearances. Ultimately, I had the highest security clearance, not because of Russia, but because of involvement with three soldiers who went to battle in 1982 and were missing in action until today. The bodies have not been returned. The Sultan Yaqub battle in Syria, if you know what I'm talking about, the Katz, Feldman, and who am I missing, and the Baumel boy, God have mercy on them. And they've been missing, imagine, since 1982. And there I was involved in very heavy intelligence where I needed permission from the Prime Minister and the Chief of Staff of the Army to follow through. But that's a different story. And that story I cannot tell in public yet. So I was briefed, Malka briefed, and 6 months later, we go to Russia. In order to get to Russia, we have to apply for a tourist visa. we had to tell a white lie as if we live in Kew Gardens Hills. You need a profession. I cannot say I'm a rabbi. I cannot say I have a doctorate in Jewish history. They're not going to let me in. I cannot say I'm a medical doctor, because if the KGB wants to question me, my brother's a medical doctor, but what do I know about medicine? I cannot say I'm a lawyer. So I picked a fabulous profession. In my new book, in my seventh book, there's actually a picture of the stationery that was in my suitcase. My friend printed it up for me. I was co-director of Freedom Finance Company. I know nothing about money, but KGB also knew nothing about money. What characterized the communist state is their lack of understanding of money. It ultimately brought them down, because people do not work for nothing. And communism is built upon the fact you do not work for a salary. You're just giving money in accordance with your needs, or your barter, you trade for what you need. It's a different system. So Freedom Finance Company, we arrive in Russia. Arriving in Russia, the middle of the winter, tourists so-called, and we have to find the one, I'm using a communist word now, the one functioning synagogue in Moscow. That's where we're going to meet the people we have to meet. The communists were very smart. They hated religion. They wrote God out of history. What did Karl Marx say? Karl Marx, by the way, who was Jewish, great communist, precursor to the communist movement. Religion is the opium of the masses. You've heard that. Your teachers have taught it to you, I hope, and explained it to you. But what could you do? There's something within us that, as much as people will try to destroy religion, Torah, commitment, not just Jews, Catholics, Protestants, there's something within us that we seek God. And you know, in the Jewish religion, we're the only religion in the world, or one of the few in the world, that we do not proselytize. We will say to a non-Jew, keep your religion. Just be a decent person, believe in monotheism, and you're a good person. You have a share in the world to come, right or wrong. We're the only people who talk that way. And don't have to be Jewish to be a good person. We're Jews. We have that responsibility to be Jewish. But you be who you are. And they couldn't wipe out religion altogether. So in every city, in Moscow, tremendous city, there was one functioning, that's a communist word, synagogue, synagoga, one functioning church, and the KGB would keep track what's going on. So the functioning synagogue was called the Choral Synagogue. Why was it called the Choral Synagogue? Because there always was a choir singing in that shul. And our first, we arrived Thursday night, finally got to the hotel after the KGB took us apart for hours. And we're looking and searching for my address book. The truth was, the address book was in my coat pocket. And when they pulled out the gloves, they never looked further. So they never found the address book. And they knew what they were looking for. Two Jewish-looking people coming in the heart of winter claiming they're tourists. But they had to allow us, because we had an American passport. And if they didn't allow Americans in, America wouldn't allow Russians in here. And Russians who came here, some of them were spies, even economic spies, industrial spies, just to bring back a catalog from Sears and Roebuck. If you don't know what I'm, you have to explain to them what this was, a Sears and Roebuck catalog. That itself was important for the communist state. Finally got to the hotel Friday morning. We went out 9 o'clock. We got to find the shul. Shabbat is early. And I have to tell you, for the first moment in the street, I write about this, and I thought I was in the heart of Jerusalem. Wherever I turned and looked, everyone is wearing a fur hat, a shtreimel, the men, the women. I said, what's going on here? Then I realized I'm in Russia, that the shtreimel originally was worn in cold weather. And that's how the Jews, the Hasidic Jews, continue to wear a shtreimel, but its origins are in the cold climate of Eastern Europe. And then we found, we took the map, we followed directions, about a 25-minute walk, and we found the synagogue. And this was an unbelievable moment, because there's a very famous stamp that the Israeli government issued. One of our early prime ministers was an American lady by the name of Golda Meir. You remember the name? Golda Meir, Meirson. You ever saw pictures of her parents? Her father had a long beard down to here. Her mother covered her hair like this. And she was part of that big rebellion. We're going to build a Zionism, a social Zionism without religion. This was the dream of these people 60, 70 years ago. They succeeded? Interesting question. Only partially. Today in Israel, you see a kippah all over the place. Meir Kahane's nephew just went up to Brigadier General, Tat-Aluf Menachem Kahane. There's a Brigadier General in the IDF. I showed in Yerushalayim, I showed the class the picture, the articles. He is the son of a Hasidic Rebbe, and he will inherit his father's Rebbeship. He's the next Hasidic Rebbe. It's in Gilo. His name is Friedman, Rebbe Hoshea Friedman. He is a direct descendant of the Ruzhin Rebbe, Rebbe Yisrael Friedman. His mother is the aunt of the present Vishnitzer Rebbe. And he is a brigadier general in the IDF. Major general this year was Aluf Naveh. Aluf Yair Naveh, who writes Divrei Torah every week. He was the second in command, Skan Ramatkal. So you see, they had a dream. Did they achieve it? I hope the Zionist part they achieved. The religious part, it totally changed. And the only ones of their descendants who are still in Israel, basically, are those who became Balei Tshuva and came back to Torah. Because you're living on the holy soil, it has an impact. Even in North Tel Aviv today, there are three tremendous shuls of outreach. One of them led by one of my students, where he did his rabbinate here as associate rabbi in the Hamptons. And a kendishtik, he knows how to do it. He has a red carpet spread out in a shul that barely had a minyan 2-3 years ago. Hundreds of youth, North Tel Aviv, march on the carpet, L'Kabel Penei Shabbat Kodesh, and he serves Kiddush, not with grape juice like you and I want to drink, with champagne. This is the Kiddush in his shul on Shabbat. So we come to the synagogue, and there's this famous stamp of Golda Meir when she was the Israeli ambassador to Russia, right after the founding of the state. And it was announced that Rosh Hashanah, she would come to this shul. And 50,000 Jews turned out. Stalin went crazy. It influenced his thinking afterwards, his hatred that the Jews still retain an identity, that they're not like all the other communist people. And they snapped a picture of her standing at the entrance to the shul. And on this entrance it said, Ein ze ki im beit Elokim v'ze shah ha-shamayim. From Bereshit, Yaakov Avinu, this is the house of God, and this is the gate to heaven. And I have a picture of Malka and myself standing in front of that very sign. Shabbos, unbelievable. You see the KGB agents walking up and down. You see the Jews on the side is the shtibel with old-time Jews who yet learned with the Chafetz Chaim, old Lubavitchers, and who knows what became of their children, their grandchildren. Saturday night, the refusnikim, the shiruvnikim, they don't let them out of Russia. The term in English is refusnik, from language refused. Hebrew, lesareif, to turn someone down. Saturday night they would meet in the subway station, hundreds passing on news, who got out, who stands a chance, who was thrown into jail. And people pointed to me, I mentioned one name, they said, there he is. Within a half hour, I'm teaching a class in a private home in Moscow. And I went on to teach. These were the greatest moments a teacher could have. Fear of the knock on the door. The very home I taught, my first Shayur lecture that I gave in Moscow, was in the very home that the KGB had raided only a few days earlier. And the Mossad wanted to see how much they will tolerate. The Mossad said, don't tell them, not more than five people, see if they let you get away with it. Everything is recorded. Neighbors are watching. People are rewarded if they squeal on you. You have no idea the way the communist system worked. Bugs are all over in every hotel room. Every word you say is recorded. A lady sits on the floor. She's called the floor lady, watching every action of the so-called tourist. You leave your room, you come back, you find your suitcase turned over, everything searched. They found my stationery. Thank God they saw. I'm a man of money, Freedom Finance Company. My dear young people, but these are Jews. These are our brothers. These are our sisters. These are our people. This is the future. This is how we're going to build the state of Israel. When we came in Aliyah 46 years ago, there were 1.5 million Jews in the state of Israel. We are rapidly heading now for 7 million in the state of Israel. Who knows what will happen this year with the tragedies of Europe, France in particular. England is not that far behind. The Scandinavian countries, the Islamic takeover, the Islamic hatred, not just for Jews, for Christians, for anyone who doesn't believe in Islam, who could believe that there was a fatwa, that's a halachic ruling, a ruling of Jewish law just 3-4 days ago, forbidden to build a snowman, because a snowman is a graven image. Person building a snowman, they can behead him in public at noon, according to their concept. And if you don't live like this, you don't deserve to live. I don't want to go further. What they promised, the reward for suicide bombers, what they think of women, their concept of the dignity of the feminine species. What are we dealing with here? What are we talking about? So these Russians, yes, they're Russian and they speak Russian and they were born in Russia and raised in Russia, but they're also Jews. And they wanted to learn. They wanted to know why they are suffering. I became very friendly with Jews in Russia who later went to jail. Yuli Edelstein, prime example. Today, Speaker of the Knesset. Last Friday night in Israel, before we left, we had supper with 10 of our friends, including names that you should know. Natan and Avital Sharansky. You've heard of these names? Kainayin Hara, Shomrei Torah and Mitzvah, their two daughters. This man rotted away in prison, came out. Their daughters are both married into Anglo families, one from Australia, one from America. Families we know. The greatest Jew alive, my dear friend, read it. Do you have his biography, autobiography? Yosef Hatzadik Mendelevich. Do you have? You open up the biography, you'll see yours truly, my picture there. When Yosef got smicha, we celebrated in his home, in my home, in our home, in Yerushalayim. There I am with Yosef Hatzadik, with Shimon Grilius, whom we made from in jail, a famous rabbi from New York, Rabbi Haskell Lookstein, and we're celebrating Yosef Hatzadik. Do you know what we're talking about? We're talking about someone who went on a hunger strike because they wouldn't let him wear a kippah in jail. We're talking about someone who saved flour and baked flour with water. He insisted he had to have matzah. Finally, he went on a hunger strike. He couldn't succeed. They saw he would die in jail, and he was too well known in the Western world, so that the Dutch embassy was able to get, they allowed the Dutch embassy to import matzah to bring to jail that Joseph Mendelovich should be able to eat during Pesach. What are we talking about here? And Baruch Hashem, don't want to go into any more details, aval ani modeh l'Kadosh Baruch Hu, I thank the Almighty that my work was successful, and the Mossad asked me to remain with them for the next 10 years. We kept the chain going. Malka and I, we let it do life. I taught, I shopped, I davened, I learned, I ate, I joked around. Klapei Chutz, the outside, thought, gee, this is a normal guy. And boy, we had a second existence, interviewing people, preparing people, determining life and death matters, what to do within. Every week I was in the secret center in Tel Aviv after I gave my lecture in the army, meeting with the Russian center. What do we do next? Who do we send the next? What messages have to be carried? Who continues teaching? And as they say, the rest is history. And I'll end off in a moment. 1 second. I was given a bottle to drink, so I want to tell you, my life was changed by the Shanghai emigres who came to America and became my rebbeim in 7th grade. I was fortunate, from 7th grade on, all my teachers were Gedolei Yisrael. So we were American kids, come to our Rebbe's house, he gives us a bottle, we start drinking. He says, in Mir Yeshiva, you drink out of a bottle? And they would bring an animal drinks out of a bottle, a human out of a cup. Baruch ato Adonai Eloheinu Melech Haolam she'hakol nihyeh bedvaro. So you see that woman on the bus reading and writing Arabic, and my students in Moscow, Leningrad, Vilna, Minsk, Riga, my students in Melbourne, Sydney, Cape Town, Johannesburg. These are people I taught in person. I'm not talking about the YU Torah website, which gets millions of hits a year. But these are not virtual Talmidim. These are real, tangible students. But what do we share? We share the fact that we're citizens of the Western world, but we're also Jews, and we care about each other. We're concerned. Arevut, interresponsibility. We're not strangers. And here I want to end off with a true story that, again, was a focal point in my life. Again, I tell the story in detail in Washington. 1976, Jordanian war bonds went up in value. Why? Because Rakefet was drafted into basic training. I wouldn't depend upon an Israeli army where Rakefet is supposed to be a sharpshooter. Thank God, my grandchildren, it's a different story. Before the Yom Kippur War, no Americans were drafted. They didn't want to start up with America, with the State Department, the dual citizenship, because technically speaking, an American is not allowed to serve in a foreign army. After the Yom Kippur War, which we survived by miracles until today, I don't know, I don't understand how we survived, but that's not for now. They took every able-bodied person living in Israel who could walk upright. Took a while till my group built up. It had to be people my age level, my health background, and army works with certain standards, and there we are. March of 76, I bid goodbye to my students. I still remember two young ladies. I remember them very well. Batya Schiff and Batya Grona, both have different last names today, were crying when I said goodbye. Rebbe's going into the army. All right, I told them, I'm also crying, but for different reasons. Ach and vey that the army has to depend upon an old guy like me at that time going in for basic. Well, we went in for basic, and it was a fabulous experience, and I later was to serve in the army, the maximum of reserve duty, all that was involved, till the computer kicked me out at the age of 54. But now you're in the army, and you know what basic training is about. They have to train you, you have to be a soldier, you have to run, you have to learn how to take orders, you have to learn how to salute. This is the hardest thing for the Jewish people, to salute someone else. You think about it. Those of you that are daughters of rabbis, daughters of synagogue presidents, activists, ask your fathers when was the last time someone saluted them. But an army has to run with a chain of command. And then once a week we would have a lecture from the educational authority. And the officer would walk in, everyone had an officer. We're trainees, and we hear a lecture. All right, the first week we heard a beautiful lecture about what happened in Lebanon in the 1970s when we came into the airport and the terrorists were coming down a elevator, and as they walked out of the elevator, shot, killed one terrorist, second terrorist, the elevator went up, another five terrorists walked out. Another five, and the whole party disappeared, got back to the Mediterranean. The little boat was waiting, and away they went back to Israel. All right, nice lecture, inspires you. Confidence in IDF, Israeli Defense Forces, Tzva Hagana Yisrael, Tzahal. And the second week, the same guy walks in, and he starts the same lecture. Well, there were about 250 sitting there. I was happy. You're not allowed to sleep. They woke up and down. But you can sleep with your eyes open when you're doing basic training. You're waking up 5 o'clock in the morning. You know, I was young. Today I wake up 5 o'clock, but that's natural. Then it was forced. The Russians doing basic started yelling, Shamanush, we heard the lecture. And this dummy evidently knew one lecture. The officer walks off. It was embarrassing. And I couldn't believe what happened. There's a conference of the sergeants who are commanding us. And until then, I'm chayal. You have no name in basic training. They got to break you, make you part of the chain. Not an individual anymore. Part of the collective chain. This is every good army in the world. You have to learn how to take an order. So you're called soldier. Chayal. Suddenly the master sergeant comes over to me. Kvod harav. Honorable rabbi. I found that lady had a girlfriend from Michlala. I didn't know it at the time. Kvod harav. We know that you know how to speak. We're in a very tight situation here. It's embarrassing. Zemavayeshotanu. Please get up and give us a shayur. We have an hour and a half. I said, okay, it's Resh Chodesh Nisan. And I got up and give you the gist, the heart, the kernel of what I said. And it's the story of modern day Israel, which I am part of, and you can be part of, and every Jew in the world can join us, and the chosen few who know how to choose will certainly join us. And I meet people today, so many decades later, who remind me about my talk, that Rosh Chodesh Nisan, the new month of Nisan, 2 weeks before Pesach. And I said, there are two covenants that God made with the Jewish people. One covenant with Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, the covenant being habitarim, between the parts of the sacrifice, that you will be Jews. And then there's the covenant we leave Egypt, and God gives us the Torah and the land of Israel. And I asked a very simple question, which my Rebbe asked this question, but he asked it quoting one of the great early scholars of 800 years ago, the Mishnah LeMelech, the Prashat Rachim commentary on the Rambam, who wrote a sefer of philosophy. Why do we need two covenants? If Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob were Jews, why the second covenant? And if they weren't Jews, which is a terrible thought, a frightening thought, then why a covenant with them? Let the covenant be only with Moses. Follow me? Why two? And my Rebbe, Mori Rebbe, Rav Soloveitchik, basing himself upon the Parashat Rachim, gave an answer that I can never forget. It shaped eternity for me. He said, we need both covenants because a Jew functions on two levels. On one level, he's an individual. And on that level, we're no different than Catholics or Protestants. Religion is a personal matter. In World War I, Christian killed Christian. Have you studied about World War I? Millions were killed. It was soldier against soldier. And then Christmas came, and they called a 24-hour truce, and they played cards together, and right after Christmas, they went back to killing each other. We Jews, can we do something like that? There's a second covenant, which is Am Yisrael, B'nai Yisrael, Adat Yisrael, Kahal Yisrael, the totality of the Jewish people. And on that second level, we are all interconnected. The Torah is not given to individuals, it's given to the people of Israel. The land of Israel is not given to individuals, it's given to the totality of Jewish existence, the Jewish people. That's why we have two covenants. And then I turn to the soldiers. I'm being very brief, but let me end off. I turned to the soldiers and I said, gentlemen, this will be a very different Pesach for us. Until now, we were Americans, Canadians, Russians, Argentines, Moroccans. We were from every country in the world. We were individual Jews. With our serving in the Israeli army, we have become a community of Jews. It's the second covenant. We interlock. We are interconnected. We become a people, a nation. We are individuals, but our totality is one. This is what basic training has done for us. And now we're ready to observe the Pesach, the real Pesach, the holiday of our becoming the people of Israel. My dear young ladies, I want to thank you very much for the privilege to be here. I want you to understand, no applause, I don't need applause, but I want you to understand, a Jew has addressed you who is 3,500 years old. What's more important, that a Jew has addressed you who is concerned with what will be with us 3,500 years from now. Life is about choice. Choose correctly. Uvachata b'chayim. I want to thank the Dennises for bringing me. We should be zeicha l'besora tova, yeshuat v'nechamot.
Thank you very much. Thank Dr. Kefet for speaking to us. I think we all got the message loud and clear.